I could use your good sense about the business," he adds.
"It's only me and Emmett."
Herr Neuhoff had been dealt a cruel blow. In the circus, large families are the norm.
Ours had four brothers, each more handsome and talented than the next.
But Herr Neuhoff's wife had died birthing Emmett, and he had not remarried, leaving him alone with just one shiftless heir who had neither the talent to perform nor the head to run the business. Instead, Emmett spent his time gambling in the cities on tour and ogling the dancing girls. I shudder to think what might become of this circus when his father is gone.
"So you'll stay?"
Herr Neuhoff asks. I consider the question. Our two families had not always gotten along. My coming here today had been a change.
We were rivals, more so than allies, until now.
I want to say no, to get on a train and keep searching for my family. I've had enough of depending on others. But Herr Neuhoff's eyes are soft. He takes no joy in the misfortune that has befallen my family, and is only trying to help. I can already hear the music of the orchestra, and the ache to perform, buried so deep I'd almost forgotten, rises sharply within me. A second chance. "All right, then," I say finally. I cannot refuse him, and I have nowhere else to go.
"We'll try it. Perhaps on the road we might hear word of where my family has gone."
He presses his lips together, not wanting to give me false hope.
"You can stay at the house," he offers.
He does not expect me to live in the women's lodge like a common performer.
"It would be good to have the company."
But I cannot stay up here and hope to have the girls accept me as one of them.
"That's very kind, but I should stay with the others."
As a child, I had always felt more comfortable down in the cabins with the performers. I had yearned to sleep in the women's quarters, which, despite the too many bodies, smells, and noises, had a kind of solidarity. He nods, acquiescing to the truth in my words.
"We'll pay you 30 a week."
In our circus, money had not been discussed. Wages were paid fairly, with increases over the years. He pulls a paper from the desk drawer and scribbles on it.
"Your contract," he explains.
I look at him, confused. With us, there had been no contracts. People made verbal agreements and kept them over decades of working together. He continues.
"It just says that if you want to leave before the season is over, you will pay us back."
I feel owned in a way I never have before, and I hate it.
"Come, I'll help you get settled."
He leads me out of the house and down the hill in the direction of the cabins. I keep my eyes straight forward, not looking back in the direction of my former home. We near an old gymnasium, and my throat tightens. Once my family had practiced here.
"They weren't using it anymore," he offers, his voice apologetic.
But it had been ours. In that moment, I regret the bargain I have made. Working for another circus family feels like treason. Herr Neuhoff continues on, but I stop in front of the gymnasium door.
"I should practice," I say.
"There's no need to start today. Surely you will want to get settled."
"I should practice," I repeat. "If I don't start now, I never will." He nods.
"Very well, I'll leave you to it."
As he starts away, I look up from the base of the hill across the valley toward my family home. How can I stay here, so unbearably close to the shadows of the past? I see my brothers' faces. I will perform where they cannot. The door to the gymnasium creaks as I pull it open. I set down my valise
twisting my wedding band around my finger. There are a few other performers scattered through the practice hall. Some faces are vaguely familiar, as if from another lifetime. Others I do not know at all. At the back of the practice hall by the piano, there is a tall man with a long, somber face. Our eyes meet, and though I do not recognize him from my circus years, it seems we have met somewhere before. He holds my gaze for several seconds before finally turning away. I inhale the familiar smell of hay and manure and cigarette smoke and perfume, not so very different. The thick rosin coats the insides of my nostrils, and it is as if I had never left. I take off the wedding band and put it in my pocket, then go to change for rehearsal.
Chapter 3. Noah. Of course I did not leave him. I started away from the child, imagining my life just as it had been a few short minutes earlier. The milk truck would go, and I could return to my work and pretend none of it ever happened. Then I stopped again. I couldn't abandon a helpless infant and leave him alone there to die, just as surely as he would have on the train. Quickly I raced to the sour-smelling milk can and pulled him out. A moment later, the engine roared, and the truck lurched forward. I clutched the child tighter, and he nestled against me forgivingly. His warmth filled my arms. In that second, everything was all right. The policeman near the train yelled something I couldn't make out. A second guard appeared on the station platform, holding a snarling Alsatian on a leash. In my panic, I jumped, and the child nearly slipped from my arms. Tightening my hold on him, I ducked around the corner as they raced past me to the train. They couldn't have possibly noticed one baby missing amid so many. They were pointing, though, from the boxcar door I left open in my haste to my telltale footprints in the snow. I ran desperately into the station, toward the closet where I slept. At the back of the closet, there was a rickety ladder leading to the attic. As I reached for it, my foot tangled around a threadbare blanket on the floor. Shaking it off, I started to climb the ladder. But I had only one arm to hold on, and I slipped from the second rung, nearly dropping the baby, whose wail rang out, threatening to expose us. Recovering, I started upward again. The voices grew louder, broken by a sharp bark. I reached the attic, a space with a low ceiling smelling of dead rodents and mold. I hurried through the tangle of empty boxes toward the lone window. My nails ripped as I pried it open. A blast of icy air smacked my face. I leaned forward and put my head through the window, but it was too small. I could not make it past my shoulders. Below, I heard the guards, inside the building now. I pushed the baby quickly through the window and placed him on the sloping, snow-covered roof that overhung the station platform. I steadied him there, praying he did not roll downward or cry out from the iciness against his skin. I closed the window and hurried down the attic steps, grabbing my broom. As I walked out of the closet, I nearly slammed into one of the guards. "Guten Abend," I stammered, forcing myself to meet his eyes. He did not respond, but stared at me piercingly. "Entschuldigen Sie bitte." Excusing myself, I walked around the guard, feeling his eyes on me, bracing for his command to stop. I slipped outside and pretended to sweep the coal-tinged snow from the platform until I was sure he wasn't watching me. Then I raced around the side of the station, staying close to the shadow of the building. I looked up at the low roof, searching for a foothold to reach it. Finding none, I climbed the drainpipe, iciness soaking through my torn tights. As I neared the top, my arms burned. I reached up, praying that the infant was still there, but my fingers closed around emptiness. My stomach dropped. Had the Germans found the baby? I stretched again, arms straining farther, and finding a bit of cloth. I pulled on it, trying to draw the child toward me. But he rolled past my fingertips. I reached for him frantically, grabbing the edge of the cloth diaper just before he fell. I drew him close to me and scampered down, nearly slipping myself as I struggled to hold on with one hand. At last I reached the ground and tucked the baby securely in my coat. But the Germans were just around the corner, their voices close and angry. Not daring to linger another second, I ran, footsteps breaking the smoothness of snow. Hours have passed since I fled the station. I don't know how many, only that it is deepest night and snowing again, the sky a muted gray, or it would have been if I could look up. The storm has grown heavier, though, sharp bits of ice cutting at my eyes and forcing me to tuck my chin once more. I'd gone in the direction away from the hills and toward the shelter of the woods, but the ground that appeared flat in the distance rolls and dips, straining my legs. I cling instead to a smoother path that runs too close to the edge of the forest. I glance nervously at the narrow road that runs parallel to the trees. So far, it has thankfully remained deserted. In the endless blanket of white, I imagine our tiny farm, close to the Dutch coast, the air thick with salt and chilled by the North Sea, where I lived with only my parents. Though we had been spared from the air raids that had brought Rotterdam to rubble, occupation had come down hard. The Germans had focused on defending the coastal towns, mining the beaches so we could no longer walk them, and billeting soldiers everywhere, which is how I met the one who fathered my child. He hadn't forced me. If he had, or if I had pretended it, my parents might have been more forgiving. He had not even tried during the fortnight he stayed at our farm, though I could tell from the long looks across the table that he wanted to. His tall, broad-shouldered presence had been too large in the close cottage space, a piece of furniture that did not fit. We all breathed a sigh of relief once he had been moved to new quarters. But he returned, bringing a half-dozen fresh eggs like we hadn't seen since before the war, and later chocolate to thank us. I was weary. The war had been raging since I was 12, taking all of the dances and normal things I might have known as a teenager with it. For the first time with the soldier, not much more than a boy himself, it seemed like I stood out. So when he came to me in the night, slipping through the back door and into my cold, narrow bed, I'd felt chosen and excited by his touch. A man so much more certain than the fumbling boys I'd known at school. I didn't see the uniform, with the same insignia that the SS marching Steffi Kleinaway had worn. He was just a soldier who had been conscripted into the army. Not one of them. My memories of our one night together are hazy, like a half-forgotten dream of desire, and then pain that caused me to cover my own mouth so my parents wouldn't hear me cry. It was over just as quickly, leaving me with a longing not quite fulfilled, and a sense that there should have been more to it. Then he was gone. The German did not come around again, and 2 days later, I learned that his unit had moved on. I knew that I had made a mistake. It wasn't until about a month later that I realized how serious my mistake had been. The end came without warning, on a spring day warmer than most. Morning sun bathed our seaside village of Scheveningen, and gulls called to one another above the inlet. Lying in my bed, it had almost been possible to forget about the war for a few minutes. Then, my bedroom door swung open, and the knowledge of the truth raged in my father's bulging eyes.
Out!
I stared at him in disbelief. How could he possibly have known? I had told no one. I had not expected to be able to keep it a secret forever, but surely for another month or so, long enough to figure out what to do. Mama, who had walked in while I was dressing a few days earlier, must have seen the slight curve of my stomach. The rest, the timing of when the German had been with us, would not have been so very hard to figure out. Papa was proud and staunchly Dutch, with a limp from the Great War to prove it. My affair with the German was the greatest betrayal. Surely, though, he did not mean for me, his only daughter and just 16, to leave. But the same man who had once laced my boots and carried me on his shoulders now unrelentingly held the door open for me to walk through a final time. I braced for him to strike me or berate me further, but he simply pointed to the door.
Go.
His eyes did not meet mine.
No,
Mama cried as I went. There was no strength behind her voice, though. As she ran after me, my heart lifted. Perhaps just this once she would stand up to him and fight for me. Instead, she just pressed the money she had tucked away into my palm. I waited for her to embrace me. She did not. A horn whistles long and low in the distance. I duck behind a tree as a train appears from the same direction we'd come, snaking a path through the field of white. Though I can't be sure, from a far distance there is a train car that looks exactly like the one from which I pulled the baby, headed east, like the other trains of Jews. Babies taken, as my own had been, but from families with two parents who loved, wanted them. Stifling a cry, I step from the trees, wanting to run after it and take other children as I had this one. But the baby's body sinks warm and heavy in my arms. The lone life I have saved. Saved, at least for now. Behind the receding train, the sky is lightening to gray in the east. It will be dawn soon, and we are still too close to the station. The police could come at any moment. Snow falls heavy, soaking my thin coat and reaching the child beneath it. We must keep going. I push deeper into the woods, out of sight. The air is still with that silence that only snow can bring. My feet are icy bricks now, legs weary. I am weak from the little I've eaten in my months at the station, and my mouth is dry with thirst. There is nothing beyond the trees but endless white. I try to remember from my journey to the girls' home months earlier how far it is to the next village. But even if we make it there, no one will risk his own life to shelter us. I switch the baby to my other hip, brushing the snow from his forehead. How long has it been since he last ate? He has not moved or cried since we left the station, and I wonder if he is still breathing. Hurriedly, I pull aside into a thick cluster of trees and unwrap him a bit more, keeping him close for warmth. His eyes are closed, and he is sleeping, or so I hope. His lips are cracked and bleeding from dehydration, but his chest rises and falls evenly. His bare feet are like tiny bricks of ice. I scan the forest desperately, remembering the other babies on the train. Most already gone. I should have taken some of their clothes for the child. I am repulsed at the thought. I unbutton my coat and blouse, grimacing at the blast of ice and snow against my skin. I hold the baby to my breast, willing some of the thin gray liquid that I'd squeezed out to relieve my discomfort nearly 4 months earlier to appear in tiny dots. But my movements are clumsy. No one had taught me how to nurse, and the child is too weak to latch on. My breasts ache with longing, but nothing comes. My milk is gone, dried up. After I'd given birth, the nurse had told me there were women who would pay for my milk. I'd shaken my head, unwilling, no matter how much I needed the money, to have that taken from me too. With my child gone, I was desperate to be done with the whole thing as quickly as possible. My child. Part of me wishes I had not held my baby that once. That my arms had not memorized the shape of his body and head. Maybe then my arms would not ache every second. Once I had considered what I would have called him, but as names appeared in my mind, a knife of pain shot through me, and I had clamped down on the thought. I wonder what he is called now. Praying he had reached people who cared enough to give him a really good, strong name. Pushing thoughts of my own child aside, I study the baby in my arms. His face is squared off a bit around the full cheeks and perfectly pointed at the chin. The shape is distinct, and I just know there is a whole family out there. Please let them still be out there, with faces exactly that same shape. Something crackles behind me in the distance beyond the trees. I turn back, squinting to see through the falling snow. But the way we've come is obscured by the tangle of branches and brush. My heartbeat quickens. It might be a car engine. Though we are well hidden by the trees now, there is a road not far from the edge of the woods. If the police followed us, my footprints in the snow would easily lead them here. I hold my breath, feeling like a hunted animal as I strain to listen through the stillness for voices or other sounds. Nothing. At least, for now. Closing my coat, I press forward through the trees. I hold the baby clumsily in one arm, using the other to clear a low branch in front of us. Snow shakes from it and falls down the collar of my coat, icy and wet. My feet, soaked through the patchy second-hand boots, begin to ache. The baby grows heavier with every step. I slow, breathing heavily, then reach down for a handful of snow to ease the dryness of my mouth, the coldness burning through the holes in my glove. I straighten, nearly dropping the child. Is he thirsty? I wonder if giving him a bit of snow will help or make things worse. Holding him at arm's length, I am suddenly helpless. There is so much I do not know. Other than those fleeting seconds after I had given birth, I have never held a child, much less cared for one. I want to set him down. Empty-handed, I might make it to the next village. He would have died in that train car anyway. Would this be so much worse? The baby's hand, no bigger than a walnut, shoots up, grasping for my finger and holding tight. What does he think when he looks up and sees a face different from the one he had known since birth? He is almost the exact same age that my own child would be. I imagine a mother whose scars still ache like mine. Looking at this child, my heart breaks open. He once had a name. How could a child, too young to know his own name, ever hope to find his parents? I will him to breathe, to keep going until we can find shelter. I cradle his head gently before covering it once more. Then, redoubling my efforts, I press on. But the wind grows stronger now, whipping the snow-clad branches at me and making it hard to breathe. Stopping a second time had been a mistake. There is no shelter other than the train station for many kilometers. If we stay here, we will die, just as surely as the child would have on that train. I can't do this! I cry aloud, forgetting in my desperation that I must not be heard. The wind howls louder in response. I try to move forward again. My toes are numb now, legs leaden. Each step into the sharp wind grows harder. The snow turns to icy sleet, forming a layer on us. The world around us has turned strangely gray at the edges. The child's eyes are closed, and he is resigned to the fate that has always been his. I take a step forward, and stumble, and stand again. I'm sorry, I say, unable to hold him any longer. Then I fall forward, and everything goes black.
Chapter 4 Astrid. The squeak of a doorknob turning, hands pressing against hard wood. At first, they seem part of a dream I cannot quite make out. The sounds come again, though, louder this time, followed by the scraping of the door opening. I struggle to sit. Sharp terror shoots through me. Inspections have come without warning in the 15 months since my return. Gestapo, or the local police who do their bidding. They have not noticed me yet, nor asked for the Ausweis Herr Neuhoff had gotten for me. The identification card, I fear, will not be good enough. My reputation as a performer is a blessing and a curse in Darmstadt, giving me the means to survive. But, at the same time, making my false identity a thin veneer, nearly impossible to maintain. So, when the inspectors come, I disappear into the bottom of one of the tarp-covered wagons, or, if there is no time, into the woods. But here, in Peter's cabin, with its lone door and no cellar, I am trapped. A deep male voice cuts through the darkness.
It's only me.
Peter's hands, which I feel so often in the night these past months, stirring me from dreams of the past I do not want to leave, rub my back gently.
Someone has been found in the forest.
I roll over. Who found them, you? I ask. Peter hardly sleeps, but walks at night, prowling the countryside like a restless coyote even in deepest winter. I reach up to touch his stubbled cheek, noting with concern the circles that ring his eyes more darkly now.
I was down by the stream, he replies. I thought it was a wounded animal.
Peter's vowels are over-rounded, V's nearly W's, his Russian accent undiluted by time, as though he left Leningrad weeks and not years ago.
So, naturally, you went closer, I say, my voice chiding.
I would have gone the other way.
Yes.
He helps me to my feet.
They weren't conscious, so I carried them back here.
His breath holds a hint of liquor, drunk too recently to have gone sour.
They?
I repeat, the word now a question.
A woman.
A bit of jealousy passes through me as I imagine him holding someone else.
There was also a child.
He pulls a hand-rolled cigarette from his pocket. A woman and child, alone in the woods at night. This is queer, even for the circus. No good can come from strange happenings or strangers. I dress hurriedly and pull on my coat. Below the lapel, I can feel the rough outline of torn threads where the yellow star had once been sewn. I follow Peter out into the frigid darkness, tucking my chin low against the biting wind. His cottage is one of a half dozen scattered across the gently sloping valley. Private quarters, saved for the most senior and skilled of performers. Though my official residence is in the lodge, a long building set apart where most of the other girls sleep. Staying with Peter had quickly become the norm. I slip back and forth at night and before dawn, with only the slightest pretense. When I came back to Darmstadt, I had meant to stay only long enough for Herr Neuhoff to find a replacement aerialist, and for me to figure out where I was going. But the arrangement worked. And as I prepared to join the circus on the road that first year, my visions of leaving waned. And I met Peter, who had joined the Circus Neuhof during the years that I was gone. He is a clown, though not the type of buffoon whom non-circus folk normally associate with the title. His performances are original and elaborate, and they combine comedy, satire, and irony with an artistry that even I have never seen before. I had not expected to be with anyone again, much less fall in love. Peter is a decade older and different from the rest of the performers. He had been born to the Russian aristocracy when there was one. Some said he was the cousin of Tsar Nicholas. In another life, we never would have met. The circus is a great equalizer, though. No matter class or race or background, we are all the same here, judged on our talent. Peter fought in the Great War. He had not sustained injuries, at least none that were visible. But there is a kind of melancholy that suggested he has never recovered. His sadness resonated with me, and we were drawn to one another. I start toward the women's lodge. Peter shakes his head and guides me in a different direction.
Up there.
The light of his cigarette gleams like a torch as he inhales. The newcomers are at Herr Neuhof's villa, also rather unusual.
They can't stay,
I whisper, though there is no one else around to hear.
Of course not, Peter replies. Just temporary shelter so they wouldn't die from the storm.
His shadow looms over me. It is not only Peter's sorrow that makes his greatness as a clown so improbable. He told me once that the first time he had tried to join a circus, they sent him away, saying he was too tall to be a clown. So he'd apprenticed at a theater in Kiev, developed an ironic persona that suited his craggy features and long-legged style, and then gone from circus to circus, building fame around his act. Peter's antics, which often feature a humorous disregard for authority, are known far and wide. Through the war years, his routines had grown more caustic, and his hatred of war and fascism less veiled. As his reputation for daring irreverence grew, so did the crowds. He opens the door to the villa, where I've been only for the holiday party Herr Neuhof throws for the entire circus each December, and a handful of other times since my return. We slip inside without knocking. From the top of the staircase, Herr Neuhof gestures that we should join him. In one of the guest rooms, a girl with long blonde hair sleeps in a mahogany four-poster bed. Her pale skin is almost translucent against the rich burgundy sheets. On the low table beside her, a baby lies in a makeshift bassinet, fashioned from a large woven basket. Moses on the Nile, watching us with dark, interested eyes. The child cannot be more than a few months old, I guess, though I have no experience with such things. It has long lashes and round cheeks that one seldom sees for all of the deprivation these days. Beautiful. But aren't they all at that age? Herr Neuhof nods toward the child.
Before she passed out, she said he is her brother.
A boy.
But where did they come from?
I ask. Herr Neuhof simply shrugs. The girl sleeps soundly. With a clear conscience, my mother might have said. She has thick, blonde plaits, like a lass out of a Hans Christian Andersen tale.
She could have been one of the Bund Deutscher Mädel, the League of German Girls, striding along Alexanderplatz with arms linked, singing vile songs about the fatherland and killing Jews.
Peter had described her as a woman, but she could not be more than 17. I feel so very old and tired by comparison. The girl stirs. Her arms shoot straight out, searching for the baby in a gesture I know all too well from my own dreams. Then, sensing emptiness, she begins to flail. Watching her desperation, the words run through my head. There is no way that is her brother. Herr Neuhoff lifts the child and places it in the young woman's arms, and instantly she calms.
Oh, wenn ich...
Dutch. She blinks, then repeats the question in German.
Where am I?
Her voice is thin, wavering.
Darmstadt,
Herr Neuhoff replies. No recognition registers on her face. She is not from these parts.
You are with the circus Neuhoff.
She blinks.
A circus.
Though to us it seems quite normal. Indeed, for more than half of my life it was all I had known. To her, it must sound like something from a fantasy tale. A freak show. I stiffen, instantly reverting to the defensive girl facing downstairs on the schoolyard. Throw her back out into the snow if we aren't good enough.
How old are you, child?
Herr Neuhoff asks gently.
I'll be 17 next month. I fled my father's house,
she offers, her German smoother now.
I'm Noah Weil, and this is my brother.
Her words come too quickly, answering questions that no one has asked.
What's his name? I ask.
A moment's hesitation.
Theo. We're from the Dutch coast,
she says with another pause.
Things were very bad. My father drank and beat us. Mother died in childbirth. So I took my brother and we left.
What is she doing here, hundreds of miles from home? No one would flee Holland for Germany now. Her story does not make sense. I wait for Herr Neuhoff to ask if she has papers. The girl studies the child's face with darting eyes.
Is he all right?
Yes, he ate well before falling asleep,
Herr Neuhoff reassures. The girl's brow wrinkles.
Ate?
Drank, I should say, Herr Neuhoff corrects. Some formula our cook made from sugar and honey.
Surely the girl would know that if she had been caring for the child. I step back toward Peter, who reclines in a chair by the door.
She's lying,
I say in a low voice. The fool girl had probably gotten pregnant. One does not speak of such things, though. Peter shrugs with detachment.
She must have her reasons for running. We all do.
You are welcome to stay, Herr Neuhoff says.
I stare at him dumbfounded. What can he be thinking? He continues.
You'll have to work, of course, when you're well enough.
Of course.
The girl sits up, spine stiffening at the suggestion that she might expect charity.
I can clean and cook.
I scoff at her naivete, imagining her in the cookhouse making pancakes and peeling potatoes by the hundreds. Herr Neuhoff waves his hand.
Cooks and cleaners we have. No, with your looks, that would be a waste. I want you to perform.
Peter shoots me a puzzled look. New performers are recruited from across Europe and beyond. The spots are competitive and hard-fought, possible only with a lifetime of training. One does not simply find talent on the street or in the forest. Herr Neuhoff knows that. He turns to me.
You need the new aerialist, yes?
Over his shoulder, the girl's eyes widen. I hesitate. Once the act might have had a dozen or more aerialists, throwing parallel passes and somersaulting past one another in midair. But we have only three now. And since my return, I'd been largely reduced to the Cordelisset and Spanish Web.
Of course, but she has never performed.
I can't simply teach her the flying trapeze. Perhaps she could ride a horse or sell programs.
There are dozens of easier jobs she can do. What is making Herr Neuhoff think that she can perform? Usually I can scout talent a mile away. Here, I see nothing. He is trying to make a duck into a swan, and such a plan would only be met with failure.
We don't have time to find another aerialist before we go on the road, Herr Neuhoff replies. She has the right look. We have almost 6 weeks until we leave for Tor.
He does not meet my eyes as he says this. 6 weeks is a blink of an eye compared with the lifetime of training the rest of us have endured. He is asking me to perform the impossible, and he knows it. She's too thick to be an aerialist, I say, appraising her body critically. Even beneath the duvet, it is plump around the hips and thighs. She is weak, soft in the middle, with an innocence that suggests she has never known hard work. She would not have survived the night in the snow if Peter had not found her. And she will not last the week here. Hearing a shuffling sound, I turn. Herr Neuhoff's son, Emmett, watches from the doorway, his doughy mouth curled as he takes in our disagreement. He had always been an odd child, playing mean-spirited pranks and getting in trouble.
"Wouldn't want to be upstaged, would you?" he sneers at me.
I look away, ignoring him. The girl is prettier than me, I have to admit, cataloging her looks relative to my own in that way all women do. Good looks will not carry her here, though. In the circus, what matters is the talent and experience, of which she has none.
"She can't stay," Peter says from his chair, the forcefulness of his voice causing me to jump.
Herr Neuhoff is a kind man, but it is his circus, and even the star performers such as Peter do not dare to disagree with him openly.
"I mean, when she's well enough, she'll have to go," he clarifies.
"Where?" Herr Neuhoff demands.
"I don't know," Peter admits. "But how can she stay? A girl with a baby. People will ask questions."
He is thinking of me, the additional scrutiny and danger their arrival might bring. Though my identity and past are quietly known among the circus folk, we've been able to maintain the pretense with outsiders, at least until now.
"We can't risk the attention."
"It won't be a problem if she's part of our act," Herr Neuhoff counters. "Performers join circuses all of the time."
"They used to," I correct in my head. New performers had joined the circus many times over the years. Once, we had Serbian animal trainers, a juggler from China. Everything had grown leaner in recent years, though. These days, there simply isn't the money to bring on more acts.
"A cousin from one of the other circuses," Herr Neuhoff suggests, his plan unfurling.
Our own performers would know differently, but the story might satisfy the seasonal workers.
"If she's all ready to perform, then no one will notice," he adds.
It is true that the audience would not pay any attention. They come faithfully each year, but they do not see the people behind the performances.
"That's very kind of you to offer me a place," the girl interjects.
She struggles to rise from the bed without letting go of the baby, but the very effort seems to wind her, and she leans back once more.
"But we wouldn't want to be a burden. As soon as we've rested and the weather breaks, we'll be on our way."
I can see the panic in her eyes. They have nowhere to go. Vindicated, I turn to Herr Neuhoff.
"You see? She can't do it."
"I didn't say that."
The girl straightens again, lifting her chin.
"I'm a hard worker, and I'm sure that with enough training, I can."
Suddenly, she seems eager to prove herself, where a minute earlier she had not even wanted to try. A kind of defiance I recognize from myself. I wonder if she even knows what she is getting herself into.
"But we can't possibly have her ready," I repeat, searching for another argument to persuade him that this will not work.
"You can do this, Astrid."
There is a new forcefulness to Herr Neuhoff's words. He stops a step short of ordering, instead willing me to agree.
"You found shelter here. You need to do this."
His eyes burn into me. So, this is how my debt is to be repaid. The whole circus has risked themselves to hide me. Now I am to do the same for this stranger. His face softens.
"Two innocents. If we do not help them, they will surely die. I won't have that on my hands."
He could no sooner turn her and the baby away than he could have me. My eyes meet Peter's, and he opens his mouth to protest once more that we would be risking everything. But then he closes it, knowing as I do that arguing further will do no good.
"Fine,"
I say at last. There are limits to what Herr Neuhoff can ask of me, though.
"6 weeks," I say. "I will try to have her ready by the time we go on the road. And if not, then she must leave."
It is the most I have ever stood up to him, and for a second, it is as if we are equals once more. But those are bygone days. I meet his stare, willing myself not to blink.
"Agreed," he relents, surprising me.
"We start tomorrow at dawn," I pronounce.
6 weeks or 6 years, it does not matter. She will not be able to do it. The girl watches me closely, and I wait for her to protest. She remains silent, though, a hint of gratitude in her wide, fearful eyes.
"But she was nearly frozen," Herr Neuhoff protests. "She's exhausted. She needs time to recover."
"Tomorrow," I insist.
"She will fail, and we will be done with her."
Chapter 5. Noah. She comes for me before dawn. I am already awake, wearing a dressing gown that is not my own. Moments earlier, I bolted upright, shaken. I dreamed that I had gone back to the rail car at the station a second time, not just to save more babies, but because I somehow knew that my own child was among them. But when I pulled open the door to the train car, it was empty. I reached into the pitch blackness and shrieked as my arms closed around nothing. I'd awoken from the dream, hoping I had not screamed aloud and startled others in the strange house. I fought to close my eyes again. I had to go back and save my child, but the image was gone. As my trembling ebbed, I reached for the baby, who slept peacefully in the basket they had made into a bassinet by my bedside. I pulled him to me, his warmth soothing. I adjusted my eyes to the still room, partly lit by the moonlight that filtered in through curtains held back by braided ropes. A low fire burned in the corner. The fine furnishings were grander than any I'd ever seen. I recalled the odd faces assembled when I'd awoken the previous day, the round circus owner, and the woman who looked at me with such distaste, and the long-faced man who had sat in the chair watching. Like the cast of characters from a story my mother read to me as a child. "The circus," they said. It is hard to believe that such a world still exists, even during the war. I might have been less surprised to find myself on the moon. I had been to the circus only once when I was 3, and I cried at the glaring lights and loud noises until my father had taken me out of the tent. And now here I am. It is strange, but no stranger than finding a boxcar full of infants, or any of the things that have happened to me since leaving home. I gazed down at the baby, freshly bathed and nestled in my arms. Theo, I'd called him without thinking when they asked. I don't know where the name had come from. He sleeps in the crook of my elbow, and I hold still so as not to disturb him. His face is peaceful, cheeks now rosy. Where had he slept before being put in the train? I imagine a warm crib, hands that patted his back to soothe him. I pray that my own child is sleeping somewhere just as safe. The previous evening, they had spoken about me as though I was not there.
"She's got a circus look about her, don't you think?"
the circus owner had said, when my eyes were closed and they thought I wasn't listening. They were sizing me up like a horse they were about to buy. I wanted to stand and say thank you but no thank you, to pick up the baby and walk into the night. But the fierce wind still howled, and through the window the hills were an unbroken sea of white. If I started out with Theo again, we would not make it to another shelter. So I let them talk about me. This isn't our place, though. We will stay long enough to save some money and then leave. Where we will go exactly, I don't know.
"You'll be paid 10 marks a week," the circus owner had said.
The price seemed shrewd, but not so low that he was taking advantage. Should I have asked for more? Perhaps it was a generous sum for one who had never performed. I know so little about money, and I am hardly in a position to bargain. After the circus, people had finished talking about me. They had left the room, and I'd fallen asleep. I'd awoken once and found my way to the water closet in the darkness. A few times something rumbled in the distance, seeming to echo off the hills. Air raids, perhaps, like the ones I'd heard so many times at the rail station. But they were not close enough to cause alarm. No one had come to the room again, until now. Hearing footsteps in the hall, I slide from the bed carefully so as not to wake Theo, wanting to open the door before anyone knocks. The woman they had called Estrid, the one who had watched me so disdainfully the previous night, stands before me now in the semi-darkness, the moonlight behind giving her a strange glow. Her jet-black hair is bobbed short and curled at the ends, framing her face. She wears no jewelry except for a pair of gold earrings with a small crimson gem in each. She is beautiful in an exotic way, with two large features that fit together perfectly. She does not smile.
"You've slept long enough," she declares without greeting or introduction. "Time to get up and start working."
She throws a leotard in my direction, faded and mended at the toe.
"You'll need to wear this."
I have no idea where my own clothes, soaked and tattered, have gone. I wait for her to leave so I can change, but she simply half-turns away.
"We haven't a day to lose. I will train you, or attempt to, anyway. I don't think you can manage it. But if you do, you may travel with us."
"Train to do what, exactly?" I ask, wishing I had thought to ask the previous evening before saying I could do it.
"Learn the flying trapeze,"
she answers. I had heard them discuss this the previous evening. They used the word aerialist, I recall now. Through the fog of my exhaustion, I had not contemplated what it really meant. Now the outrageousness of the proposal crashes down upon me. They want me to climb to the ceiling and risk my life swinging like a monkey. I'm not captive here. I don't have to do this.
"That's very kind of you, but I hardly think..."
I don't want to offend her.
"I can't possibly do that. I can clean, or perhaps cook," I offer, as I had the night before. Herr Neuhoff owns the circus, she informs me. This is what he wants. Her diction is polished, as if she is not from around here. Of course, if you can't manage it, you have maybe a rich uncle waiting to take you in? Though her tone is mocking, she has a point. I cannot go back to the station, where surely the baby and I have both been noticed missing by now. On my own, I might have kept running. But the bitter cold had nearly killed us once. We would not make it a second time. I bite my lip. I'll try. 2 weeks. 2 weeks will give me time to get stronger and find somewhere for Theo and me to go. We will not, of course, stay with the circus. We were going to give you 6. She shrugs, not seeming to care. Let's go. I change into the leotard as modestly as I can beneath the gown. Wait. I hesitate, looking at Theo, who still sleeps on the bed. Your brother, she says, emphasizing the second word. Theo, isn't it? Yes. She hesitates for a beat, watching me. Then she picks him up. I fight the urge to protest, the notion of anyone else holding him unbearable. She places him into the makeshift bassinet. I've asked the housemaid Greta to come up and watch him. He's colicky, I say. Greta has raised 8 of her own. She'll manage. Still, I hesitate. It is more than just Theo's care that concerns me. If the maid changes his diaper, she will learn that he is a Jew. I take in his clean outfit and realize it's too late. Someone already knows the truth about his identity. I follow Estrid down the stairs of the darkened house, the air musty and burnt. Then I put on my still damp boots, which stand by the front door. She hands me my coat, and I notice that she does not wear one. Her figure is flawless, lean legs that belie her strength, and a perfectly flat waist, like I'd had before the baby. She is shorter than I thought the previous day, but her body is like a statue, elegant lines seemingly carved from granite. Outside, we ped silently across the open field, our footsteps crackling against the ice. The air is dry and milder, though. Had it been like this a day ago, I might have made it farther into the woods without collapsing. Moonlight shines down brightly. The night sky is filled with stars, and for a second, it seems that each is for one of the infants on the train. Somewhere, if they are still alive, Theo's parents are wondering where their child has gone. Hearts crying out in anguish, just as my own does. I look at the sky and send up a silent prayer, wishing they might know their son is alive. Estrid unlocks the door to a large building. She flicks a switch and lights splutter on overhead. Inside, it is a run-down gymnasium that smells of sweat, old tumbling mats rotting in the corner. It is dingy and worn, worlds away from the glamour and sparkle I'd always associated with the circus. Take off your coat, she instructs, stepping closer. Her bare arm brushes mine. My own pale skin is marred 1,000 times with moles and scars, but Astrid's is a smooth, unbroken canvas of olive, like a lake on a day without wind. She produces beige tape that she wraps around my wrists slowly and methodically, then kneels and covers my legs with chalk, taking care not to miss a single spot. Her nails are perfectly polished, but her hands are lined and coarse, unable to hide the years the way her face and body can. She must be close to 40.
Finally, she pats a thick powder onto my hands.
Rosin, you must keep your hands dry, always. Otherwise,